The fact that the most difficult thing you've done in your life is stop drinking a carbonated caffeine product means you are the definition of first world problems.
Welcome to Season 1, Episode 4 of Bad Voltage. My name's John O'Bacon.
My name's Jeremy Garcia.
And I'm Stuart Langridge. We do not have, to be clear, the fourth member the team with us. Once again.
lazy bastard, by the way. I mean, it's 50% of the show, something like that?
Yeah.
Your powers of observation serve you well.
He did, however, manage to raise himself from his deathbed, or more appropriately, his holiday in London, for long enough to send us a message which he asked to be read. John, have you got the message?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to him, right? I mean, last time he couldn't join us because he was having networking issues. This is Brian Lunduke, by the way, for those of you who don't know who we're talking about.
Oh, yes,
this time, he's claiming illness.
To be clear, though, I mean, let's be clear here. A cynic might say that last time he was on holiday in Amsterdam, and this time he's on holiday in London. And conveniently enough, he wasn't able to make it to the show. But nonetheless, let's go with him. So he's terribly unwell.
We would never ever suggest that. But he did send us, his mum sent us a note saying, Dear Bad Voltage listener, I must apologize. Hang on, I should do it in his voice. Dear Bad Voltage listener, I must apologize for my absence. Because of my inability to be there today, you will undoubtedly be forced to listen to far more of Stuart than the UN would consider acceptable. I will be back next episode. Yeah, right. And I promise to let Stew talk as little as possible during that episode.
Awesome.
Hugs and kisses, Brian Lunduke Esquire.
I thought you were doing it in Brian's voice.
I was trying to. Okay. I'm not very good at impressions.
Let's talk about
what is on this show. We're gonna have an episode, a segment on the show where we're gonna talk about open source health and whether we have a health issue in the open source community and what we can do about that.
And we're also going to interview Geek Dad, the former editor-in-chief of Wired, the author of The Long Tail, and now the CEO of 3D Robotics, Chris Anderson.
I get to review Ender's Game, the film, recent film that came out.
We're also going to get to some of the wonderful emails that you sent over.
I want to talk about backups, which a lot of people don't think is interesting, but you'd be surprised. You would honestly be surprised. Shut up, Jono.
And now, Bad Voltage.
In the past, I've raised this as a topic before, but I think it's good to revisit it right now. I wonder whether we have an issue with health and people taking care of themselves in the open source world. Now, I'm tying this very specifically to open source people, right? One of the things I've observed, and I've observed going to conferences and whatever else, is there's a lot of obesity, there's a lot of obsession about caffeine, there's a lot of drinking. People generally seem to eat fairly unhealthily. This is not everybody, but this is a pattern that I've seen, in our community. And it's worried me for a while that people are spending hours and hours in front of computers. They're not getting out. They're not getting some exercise. They're not learning how to cook for themselves, things like that. And believe me, I'm not a healthy person. All right. I'm a good example of all of these things. But what I'm interested in talking about is, first of all, do we think that that's still an issue today? And secondly, we've seen a lot of focus on technology to solve these issues. You've got scales that will transmit your weight to the internet so people can lose weight. There's Fitbits, there's fuel bands, there's watches with GPS on them to track when you run and all that kind of stuff. There's Wii Fit and things like that. So are gadgets here to solve the open source health issues? What do you guys think?
Well, I like the fact that this is you're postulating this as specifically a problem for the open source community. Like, when you go to a tech conference, all the open source people are head down in a bucket full of chicken wings, and all the people who write programs for Windows 8 are doing press ups the whole time, because that's not my experience.
No, it's not so much that this is only affecting open source. I'm focusing on open source because that's what I care about most. I think that this is a wider issue. This isn't just open source. This is people who are interested in, like you say, Windows, or people who are interested in gaming, or people who are interested in music, whatever. I mean, you know, the heavy metal world is not one filled with kale.
It is not.
I think one aspect of it, you know, the maybe weight issue might impact the open source community a little bit more than the general tech community, just because I think a lot of people interested in open source will sit at a job for 8 to 10 hours in front of a computer and then go home and their passion happens to be also sitting at a computer. So you have people that are sitting at a computer for 11, 12 hours, you know, in a day, 5, 6, maybe more days a week. And I think there's some research that kind of is linked prolonged sitting with a variety of health issues, you know, mostly centered around metabolic syndrome, which seems like an obvious thing, because when you sit for that amount of hours, your metabolism is going to clearly slow down.
So do you think these gadgets, do you think, Jeremy, that they're helping? I mean, you know, it seems like we all agree that there is something of an issue here, but do we think that these gadgets are going to help in different ways?
I think used properly, they, could help motivate people. I don't have a Fitbit or anything like that. I do have one of the scales that, you know, weighs you and tracks kind of your weight and blood pressure and percentage of body fat and that stuff across time. I know for me personally, I try to not sit for more than maybe 2 hours at a time, even if it's just getting up for 3 minutes. You know, in the summer, I also try to run at least 5 or 6 days a week, and then I try to lift 5 or 6 days a week. So I don't know that I'm in the
average. I don't think you're included in this demographic.
But I'll say it still takes a toll on me even doing that much. So if I didn't do any of that, I can imagine where it would spot
I really feel like I should probably step in here, since I'm the only one who actually could do with extra health stuff here, right? Jono, I eat nothing but yogurt, bacon. And Jeremy, I look like Tony Stark Garcia, right? You two, shut up.
I do not eat, by the way. Two things there. I don't just eat yogurt, right? Did you say you live in California? We don't just eat yogurt over here.
Oh, no, sorry, no, you're right. You eat yogurt and fruit. Right, okay.
Just like in England, you don't just eat boiled meat all the time, right? And also, world's shortest Tony Stark.
Settle it down, Dikembe Mutombo. You're like 2 inches taller than me.
Fair.
If I could drag you guys back to the point for just a moment, I like the fact that now there's a Fitbit and a Nike Fuel Band and all this kind of thing, which is great, presumably as long as you're prepared to spend even longer in front of the computer compiling libFitbit to make it work. So I'm not sure this actually helps all that much, to be honest with you.
Maybe that does help, right?
I mean, yes, but to be honest with you, there's to some extent an idolization of this sort of thing. You mentioned caffeine as a perfect example, right? And people consider it heroic. I get to be all smug about this because I don't drink coffee at all. But how much coffee you've drunk in a day, it's horrific. How much coffee someone's drunk in a day is a mark of achievement in our community and the tech community at large. And that's surely more harmful than occasionally choosing to eat a Mars bar and not go jogging for 10 miles out of guilt.
I have to tell a little story here that I think I mentioned before on Lug Radio that I think both of you guys know, but this bit me pretty hard when I was younger, because when I first got into Linux, I was at university and I used to stay awake all night programming, and I was just really I was excited and getting into it and all the rest of it. And I used to drink 6 to 8 cans of regular Coke every night. Because it's just like, you know, you're excited and you drink Coke and it keeps you awake and all the rest of it. And I went to the doctor about 2 or 3 months later because I was getting weird headaches and my vision was blurry and all the rest of it. And the doctor was like, you know, did you have any weird dietary things going on? I said, well, I drink 6 or 8 cans of Coke a night. He was like, yeah, you need to stop doing that.
I can't believe you're still alive.
And he said, I want you to go off that cold turkey. And I tell you, it's the hardest thing I've done in my entire life was stopping that. It was miserable. It was what I imagine coming off heroin must be like. I had shakes. I was constantly throwing up.
Save me, brothers. And I've got that fat Coke monkey on my back.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with telling this story is I say, yeah, I got really hooked on Coke when I was younger. You know, you got to be careful. But it is. I think caffeine is really dangerous, and I don't think a lot of people really understand that because they just associate with having a cup of coffee every couple of hours. You know,
the fact that the most difficult thing you've done in your life is stop drinking a carbonated caffeine product means you are the definition of first world problems.
There is that. Fair. I mean, I do think Mr. Bacon, as facile as he is most of the time, has a bit of a point in that it probably wouldn't kill me. Well, it probably wouldn't hurt too much if I went jogging every now and again. There's an outside chance it might kill me, which is why I don't do it.
I will say I feel a lot better. Death. You sleep better. It really does make a marked difference if you do some fairly regular exercise.
No, I mean, I do agree with that. But I'm not sure it's... I'm not necessarily sure it's particularly prevalent in the tech community, and I'm not sure it's particularly more prevalent in the open source segment of it.
Well, let's turn this around a little bit. We've been talking about physical health issues. I want to raise another interesting, I think, area of discussion, and that is psychological health or mental health, because there was an interesting thread on Ask Reddit about 6 months ago, which was psychologists or mental health professionals of Reddit, what mental health issues have you observed on the internet? And obviously everybody said you can't judge mental health conditions based upon comment threads. But one of the most prevalent responses there was something called narcissistic personality disorder. A lot of these folks were saying, you see this everywhere on the internet. This is people with an elevated sense of self-worth and an obsession over details. And that basically describes a huge number of people who I think most of us tend to deal with on a day-to-day basis. Do we think that there is an impact in the open source and the technology world on our mental health? Because I'm almost convinced that there is.
I can believe that. To some extent, I think that's probably self-selecting, though, right? I mean, in the same way that that's like saying the tech community tends to have a preponderance of people who are good at concentrating for long periods and delivering a product. Because if you're not good at that, you won't do very well in the community. Yes, whether the tech community, whether it's a good idea for it to be narcissistic is another question. But it is, I would agree with that. And therefore, if you also are, you're more likely to fit in than if you are not. So to some extent, this is self-selecting. It's not a good thing that it is. And I can see why a bunch of psychologists said this. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, don't really know what I'm talking about, but it sounds like a plausible argument to me, if nothing else.
Right, I was going to say I'm in no way qualified to speak on this, and I'm not nearly as educated on the topic to even be able to offer an opinion, but it seems to me a lot of people kind of have an online persona that is a little bit more aggressive and probably would manifest itself in what you're saying when, if you met them offline, they wouldn't necessarily, to a psychologist, look like the same person, so... I don't know if it's a tech community that has that more, or if it's their online persona manifests itself like that.
I mean, I've seen this in my career where some, what I think in the regular world would be considered fairly antisocial personality traits are like put front and center in the way people work with other people. I've seen this in Canonical. I've seen this in other companies. People who are very, very extreme in the way they engage, not malicious, not aggressive, nothing like that, but just very kind of, I don't know, just very, very, I don't know the best way of describing it, like type A kind of thing, you know?
But I think to some extent that's because that's the community and the world that you're in. I'm reasonably confident that if you went to talk to a bunch of people who are in finance in the city, they would say, yeah, loads of people are like that. I think that's just... there are people who are like that, you know? I mean, your point, we've talked about how these things happen, the potential health issues in the community. What do you see, if anything, as changing that?
Right, well, that was going to be my next question because, you know, to a reasonable extent, if you're overweight, you can get a Fitbit and you can exercise. But I don't know that there is a solution out there for mental health issues outside of spending time away from your computer as much. I can't think, I mean, you know, in 20 seconds, I can't think of what we can do.
I think that's a reasonable point. But there's been since the beginning, people saying, take time away from your machine, unplug when you go on holiday. Like Jeremy says, get up away from the desk, even if it's only for 5 minutes, an hour. And that, I think, is not a bad piece of advice, regardless of whether it's for your physical health or your mental health or just to get a cup of tea.
So let us know what you think about this. I think this is a great thing where we have a lot of people who listen to the show who will have good input on this, right? send us a mail to show@badvoltage.org or go to our forum, go to community.badvoltage.org and let us know what you think. Maybe you've got some tips and some advice, some experience for how maybe some of you folks have battled either obesity or some mental health issues or whatever it might be. Go and share your thoughts.
I liked Ender's Game. Specifically, I liked the book. Liking a book basically calls for fear and trepidation and terror when they let on it's going to be made into a film because of Hollywood's legendary ability to take a thing you love and sod it up in pursuit of mad dollar. Watchmen, V for Vendetta, I am looking at you. So, does Ender's Game the film follow in the footsteps of all these other bomb creators, or did they do a good job of it? Well, sorta. One of the reasons Ender's Game the book was popular is that it wasn't just a light fairy tale which happened to have the occasional laser beam in it. There are some fairly dark edges to the book. Bonzo dies, Ender struggles with his culpability for it, the very idea of xenocide considered in depth. Now the film, to its credit, doesn't shy away from that moral dimension. It specifically explores how military training encourages the children to hide their emotions, just like the last cream cake when your fat brother comes round. It's very Full Metal Jacket, with the first half being all the training, second half being the battle sequences. The training is a deep, meaningful exploration of character dynamic, and the battle sequences are just one more CGI company's wet dream of explodey stuff in space. This is made 100 times worse when you combine it with Hollywood's desperate desire to show all computer UIs as happening on transparent glass. Have you actually tried to use a UI when you can see right through it to the stuff behind? We should take away every single movie producer's iPad, make them actually type things on the front of a motorbike helmet until they get it. Anyway, ignoring that, the film does a pretty reasonable job of translating a fairly complicated book to the big screen. They even improved on a few things, one of which the book sequels also got right. The dreadful, terrible attacking aliens are now called Formix instead of the exceedingly unfortunate choice of buggers. However, the film itself, surrounded by scandal, or at least the author of the book is, Orson Scott Card, who wrote Ender's Game in the mid-80s, has spent the last decade or so making bigoted comments about how gay marriage will destroy the Republic and how he'll fight to bring down the government because of it. A New York pressure group, Geeks Out, campaigned for the tech community to boycott the film. The movie's producer, director, actors, pretty much all condemned Card's views, almost to the point of saying they have lots of gay friends. DC Comics have planned to have Orson Scott Card write an issue of Adventures of Superman, but they canned that idea after a very similar protest. Now, the boycott might not have significantly affected the film's profits, and it's not very clear whether Card actually gets any of that money anyway, but it certainly brought the conversation front and centre. The media jumped all over the chance to talk about the controversy, which in itself is a bit of a victory. Having said this, controversy sells movie tickets, and any publisher will tell you that having a film made of a book means you ship a shed load of books. Is it right to assess a film based on its homophobic author? Anyway, Ender's Game, the film. The Bad Voltage verdict? Mildly entertaining fun, but nothing to write home about. The enemy's thumb is down.
So it sounds like you generally were pretty supportive of the movie. It sounds like it was pretty good, right?
Yeah, it wasn't too bad, actually. I mean, it wasn't brilliant, and I am contaminated by being a fan of the book. But, yeah,
I
mean...
You're just contaminated.
Well, there is that. No, I mean, the film, I thought, was a pretty reasonable kind of, you know, fairly bog-standard science fiction film. Some stuff blows up, there's some character development, well done, whatever. So... managing the expectations from having read the book and then expecting Graf to be fat and so on didn't happen. But they do a reasonable job, I think, with the film. If you just watch the film, it's quite enjoyable. And you know what Hollywood films are like these days, right? It's all quite dramatic and well shot. The cinematography's good, so on and so forth. So that's not really a problem.
So for the benefit of our listeners who may not have read the book or seen the movie, and I will put myself squarely in both of those categories.
Yeah, or our presenters as well, right?
So that makes two of the three of us have not read the book or seen the movie. Do you want to give us just a brief synopsis? Because you said that the movie was similar to the book, but if you didn't read the book,
right, okay.
Tell us what it's about.
Brief synopsis of the story. There's a kid called Ender Wiggin, hence Ender's Game. It's set at some indeterminate point in the future, and Ender is taken to what they call Battle School, which is a military training school for kids who are to fight the alien invasion. There was a previous alien invasion, and humanity survived just about, basically because of one guy whose name was Mazer Rackham. This was about 100 years ago, something like that. Since then, they've been basically training new kids to lead the armies, to be part of the armies, to fight back in case the invasion comes again. And the and the story is about this kid, Ender, who goes to battle school and ends up being 1,000 times better than all the rest of them. He's a little weak kid, at least initially, but he's put in all these situations where he has to man up to a dramatic extent. it shows him dealing with the other kids at the school, dealing with the teachers, learning to fight. There's lots of very cool kind of zero gravity scenes and things like that. Learning to fight, to pilot spaceships, that sort of thing. I don't want to give the last bit away, but that's the basic premise of the story.
Is it like a kid versus kid kind of vibe, like in Lord of the Flies? Or is it more about Ender's deal?
To some extent, but Lord of the Flies is kind of everyone versus everyone. This is very much set up as Ender versus everyone. And it becomes clear through the book, clear through the film, absolutely, that the teachers are deliberately setting him up to be isolated, to have to fight all the time, in order that it will make him a better commander when the time comes.
Right. Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. So it's a fairly psychological study of this kind of environment. What happens when you take a genius kid and deliberately isolate him, deliberately make him fight for everything that he's got in order to make him a better commander? Is that a good idea? Is it needlessly cruel to do this to children? Take their childhood away and make them part of the army, so on and so forth, right? And that sort of thing is looked at in a certain amount of depth.
Now, with a lot of science fiction, I think there's two types of science fiction. There's fairly accessible science fiction, things like Star Wars and things like that, that I can get into as somebody who is somewhat interested in science fiction. And then you've got crazy, hardcore, nerd-tastic science fiction where people buy blueprints of all of the different vehicles and stuff like that. Which of those two categories would you say this fits into?
This is the former. Most decent science fiction uses the fact that there are laser beams or aliens or whatever as a framing thing for the story. But the story could have just as easily happened if it wasn't set in the future, if it was set in the past or whatever. And Ender's Game's like that. I mean, the sci-fi stuff is there, and there are reasons for it, but it's not a core part of the story. You can imagine doing a similar kind of story in the American Civil War or something like that, you know?
Gotcha. And, you know, we can't really talk about this without talking about Orson Scott Card and his hatred of the homos. So what's the deal here? I mean, what's going on?
Right. He is, and I can't speak to this in any great detail. I mean, as I mentioned in the review itself, there was a boycott organised by this group in New York called Geeks Out. Orson Scott Card has been, he was on the board of a group called the National Organisation for Marriage, who I believe are quite famous in the US, yes?
Never heard of them.
Oh, okay.
Never heard of them either.
For about 10 years or so, he stepped off a couple of years ago, and they are very pro, quote, traditional marriage, unquote, very anti-gay marriage, very anti-homosexuality. Card himself has made comments along the lines of, if the government decides to make gay marriage legal, we should fight against them to our last breath, and I certainly will be doing so. And so on. So I don't know. I don't know whether he's digging a moat around his building as we speak, but he's been pretty firm about the fact that he doesn't like the idea that people should be allowed to be homosexual if that's the way they are. You know, he thinks that he believes that should be stamped out. Incorrectly. He's a pretty high profile anti-homosexual campaigner.
What's interesting about that is a lot of people have a similar kind of viewpoint about guns, right? You know, like you can you're not having it until you pry it from my cold, dead hands, all that kind of stuff. But that's typically born out of defending yourself against the government. It's interesting that the guy's got a similar kind of perspective against gay marriage, which usually people object because of religious and quote-unquote ethical reasons. I've never seen it to that level, to that extent. I've never heard of it to that extent.
Right. He's... I wasn't necessarily going to say this. He's a Mormon card. Now, I don't necessarily think that... I certainly don't think this is a common Mormon belief, but... The impression I have from reading about it is that that's what's informed his belief.
Right, gotcha. Do you feel like ticklish
subject here, because I don't know much. I don't really know what I'm talking about here, and so I don't want to, you know, inadvertently offend people.
That usually doesn't stop you.
Never. You knew about this before you read the book, right?
No, good Lord, no. No, the book came out in 1985, and I read it.
Oh, but you knew about this before you watched the movie.
I knew about it before I watched the movie.
Did it affect you watching it? I mean, you know, like these kinds of things can sometimes affect the way people enjoy entertainment or whatever. Did it affect you?
I was conscious of it. One of the things that that became very apparent is that everyone who made the movie vehemently does not agree with Orson Scorcard's opinion on this. Now, right. there was a certain amount of a snide accusation out there in the press that the reason people, the reason the movie was saying that was because they were terrified they'd get boycotted and not make very much money. But I don't think so. I think these are honestly held opinions by the director came out against it, the producer.
I think most sane Harris, people vehemently Harrison disagree Ford. With his
Well, yeah, exactly. Position. Most sane people do, absolutely. This is the point. So going into the movie, I'd already... decided to think, right, okay, I'm not going to treat this as a movie of the book, because every time there's a book I like and they make a movie of it, they screw it up. So, best just not going to disassociate yourself from these things, right? So, it was kind of there in the back of my head, but I didn't think, oh no, this has tarnished the movie for me forever.
Right. It's kind of like me and Chick-fil-A. You know? Like, delicious chicken sandwich. Not big fans of the gays, but... Well, no,
this is exactly it. And there's a whole big question about how much do you let, how much does an author's views, or how much should they affect your enjoyment of that author's work?
Right. I mean, you're always going to find, like, I'm sure that all of our favourite things have been created by people who ideologically are quite different to us. I don't know, it's tough, isn't it? But it sounds like overall,
definitely a slippery
good movie.
Slope.
Yeah, I mean, average movie, I would say. Not brilliant, but it was never
going to be
brilliant.
But you are a huge fan of the considerable use of the transparent glass UI.
Oh, I so much. Bloody Steven Spielberg. You know, for Minority Report, he went away and got a bunch of pro-user experience people to design what they thought the UI would look like in 20 years. And the idea that everyone's just going to drag around all these pretty pictures on a piece of glass in front of them, it's bullshit. Stop doing it. So annoying. Really gets up my nuts.
I certainly hope that whoever's working on that technology is successful, just to prove you wrong.
Well, I will look forward to you waving your hands about like you're doing semaphore at an airport, and I'll have a laptop. Thank you very much.
So today on the show, we've got an interview with Chris Anderson, who has a fairly diverse experience. You're an author, working with robotics, editor of Wired, ex-editor of Wired. So, Chris, why don't you give us an overview of how you got started?
Okay, so I'm currently a CEO, I am a CEO of 3D Robotics. We are a drone company, and this is something I've been doing for the last year as CEO, but it's something I started way back in 2007, basically as a hobby. Created, you know, kind of interested in robotics, wanted to do something that hadn't been done before. It looked like this sort of air was somewhat uncharted territory in terms of robotics, but something I knew nothing about. So I created a website called DIY Drones, which was really just designed to kind of think in public about what was possible with aerial robotics. And that company, the website took off, the community took off, the innovation in the community took off, and that turned into a company, which then turned into a bigger company, which I... was became big enough for me to quit my day job as editor of Wired and take over full time as CEO of this.
Would you say that your experience at Wired kind of led to this? I mean, you must have been dealing with all kinds of different types of technology as an editor of Wired.
Yeah, you know, I think actually I'd like to say yes, but I think the reality is it kind of predates it. My background, my original training was computational physics, and it was only really that physics, you know, kind of shut down as a job opportunity back in that day that I ended up going into media, first through scientific journals and then ultimately in Wired. But, you know, that's where my heart has always been. And if you think about it, drones, aerial robots, are really just computational physics. And I think it was just really waiting for the technology to make it, to mature to the point that I could, you know, once again do that. So it's kind of a follow your heart moment. Now, it's true that, you know, as editor Wired, I was kind of exposed to a lot of new technologies. Once I spotted something that was interest and started a community, that I probably had, you know, some unfair advantages in attracting attention to that community, which allowed the community to grow, et cetera. But in reality, I think this is, in a sense, my career coming full circle back to what I originally, you know, where my heart was originally at. And today, what we basically do is use kind of media techniques to help build a community, rather than anything more explicit that I've inherited from publishing.
Yeah, actually, I took a look at the 3D robotic stuff, and the fact that you guys are doing some open source DUI models, it's just a really cool thing. And kind of timely with Amazon just making that announcement that they're, you know, estimating their drone delivery with they're calling it Prime Air or something.
Prime Air, yeah.
Yeah, they're saying it's 4 to 5 years out, and I know UPS just said that they're, you know, putting some R&D into that stuff. And the FDA guidelines, I think, are supposed to come out around 2015 on this. What do you think is kind of the realistic evolution of personal drones in that 3 to 5 year span? And kind of a follow-up question is, the technology component of that aside, what do you think some of the social implications of drones kind of flying all over the place are going to be?
Yeah. Well, the timeline is actually, both much faster than what you've heard and also slower. So when I say faster, I mean, you already have hundreds of thousands of consumer drones out there already, depending on how you define drone. We define drone as, aerial robots, which is to say capable of autonomous flight, automatic takeoff, landing, GPS waypoints. You know, you don't have to pilot them, but optionally pilot it, I guess is the phrase. And in that category, there are, you know, we're actually a relatively small player. We have tens of thousands of them out there like that. But, you know, there's companies like DJI and out of China who are in the hundreds of thousands. And so that's, you can even see them in your local park today. They look like quadcopters and they're flying GoPro cameras, but they basically have autopilots. They have GPS. Forgive me, the noise in the background.
They're after the drones.
So we're already seeing lots of them out there. They're used for, you know, largely recreational use. They are, they use some of the autonomy and things like they return to home and they hold position and things like that. But they're not, you know, typically doing the kind of things that folks, like military UAVs do in terms of fully autonomous missions. And the next step of that is going to be some commercial applications like agriculture, which are allowed today. So I think that kind of stuff is happening faster in the timeline that you described. And we see that being, you know, basically that's kind of falling into toy categories, the kind of stuff you can buy on Amazon or Brookstone today and, you know, ultimately it will be on the shelves of Walmart probably within 5 years. The stuff that Amazon was describing of drone delivery, that's actually probably going to take longer than they described, at least in the scenario, like, you know, delivering a package to a suburban doorstep. Not just because of the technology. I mean, you have a really tough sense and avoid problem, which is that you have to sort of, you know, navigate the aerial, you know, the airspace around homes, which is trees and dogs and children and telephone lines and birds and things like that. But you also need to convince the FAA that you're doing it, you know, not only as well as a human, but ideally better. And, you know, that's a little bit of Silicon Valley's pace of innovation and a lot about Washington, D.C.'s pace of innovation. And I think that's going to be the gating factor.
And, you know, following on from that with Jeremy's question as well is, yeah, what do you see as the social implications for this. I mean, one of the things that's been talked about in the past is how drone use in the military almost takes the it takes the psychological relationship between the two opposing sides out of the mix. It kind of dehumanizes conflict a little bit. How do you feel like that's going to apply to drones flying around our streets and villages?
Amazon's already pretty dehumanized, I think, isn't it?
You know, it's a lot of technologies got their start in the military, and were quickly demilitarized and lost their sort of terrifying edge. So, you know, GPS started as cruise missile controllers, the internet started as ARPANET, even computers began in the military, so things like artillery control. And I mean, I think very quickly, once they become mainstream and, you know, and democratized, you know, we just don't feel that sense of I don't know, menace that's associated with original military origins. And so I think, you know, today you say drone, you know, you think Hellfire missiles, Afghanistan, but you know, but efforts like Amazon's and our own are really designed to change the, to destigmatize, to change the context of drones. And we want to overwhelm the negative examples with positive examples. So, I mean, you describe a situation where they're flying over your backyard. Well, that's illegal. That's been illegal for 30 years. It's going to be illegal for a long time. That's illegal by the FAA's current rules in the United States and in many other countries that ban the use over built-up areas and people. And so we actually don't need new laws in terms of privacy. These are already regulated in terms of airspace safety. And so I think that those kind of scenarios are going to be slow to come about. And you know, you've already seen people go to jail for flying drone in Manhattan. It turns out it wasn't even the FAA. It was reckless endangerment they ended up being locked up for. Now, you know, what's much more likely is you're going to see this thing buzzing across, you know, over fences, over you know, energy infrastructure, wind farms, borders, things like that. Much more kind of, you know, away from people, you know, away and doing a job.
Now, Chris, you're not only well known for editing Wired, but you're also very well known for your book, The Long Tail: Why the Future of Business is Selling. Is selling less of more. And you're obviously, you know, CEO of this company as well, that's heavily involved in this technology. Where do you see the business opportunity here of drones?
Yeah, so this is you know, really the long tail of aerospace, if you will. So, you know, just quickly, the long tail basically made the point that, you know, what it did was democratize distribution. And what that meant is you had infinite shelf space. And so all those products and services, at least in the digital space, that didn't make sense for broadcast and didn't make sense for Walmart shelves, you know, just weren't necessarily popular enough, could suddenly get out. And we would, and the marketplace could then, you know, have more choice, but ultimately innovate by sort of, you know, exploring a wider diversity of what products could be. And that is the story of the last 20 years. And we don't really need to say more about how well that worked. We now have the ability to do the same thing with physical goods, and of which the drone is one. So the aerospace industry, military industrial complex, basically develops products according to a procurement spec from a big customer, largely military. And you know, and what you get is what you have today in military drones, which is they're designed to fight wars and things like that. All those other applications, you know, so basically you got mainframes. You know, the existing industry builds mainframes. You know, our job as a community and our job as a company is to build personal computers. And that is to say, make these things cheap, easy, you know, accessible, and put them in the hands of customers who will figure out what they're really for. And I think what we're going to discover is there is an infinite number, and there's an unlimited number of applications for drones that I have no idea about. And it can never figure out, and not nearly smart enough or knowledgeable enough about any one of these domains to come up with a good answer. But if we put them out there as a platform, as a sort of an easy to use technology, then the customers will figure it out. And so our job is to we have a platform. We have the leading open UAV platform with APM and now PicTalk, our new autopilot. And our job is to basically create an app store, if you will, for drones, so that the same way that Apple didn't build a phone, but didn't ultimately know what it would be for, and the App Store answered that question with a long tail of applications. By building an App Store for drones, we can do the same thing with, you know, with the air.
Fantastic. Well, interesting. It's an exciting time. It sounds like the technology is there. And Chris, you're right at the forefront of it. Where can people find out more about what you're doing?
So our company is 3D Robotics, and we make multicopters, planes, autopilots, technologies, etc. And that's the hardware side of the business. The community is a nonprofit, a free community that's DIY drones. And that's where most of the software work is being done. It's all open source. It's a big dev team. It's still very much on the stuff that you guys have pioneered. That's kind of social model. And that's where the platform's being built.
Wonderful. Well, thanks, Chris. And thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you.
One of the most boring things you can possibly imagine to talk about is backups. And yet, this is why I teach you that you are wrong, right? Because you get an awful lot of people who will tell you, you need to be using this thing, you need to be using this other thing, whatever. And then you have to learn about words like rsync and things, and I just don't care. So, The important point is, I wanted to ask you guys, do you actually care enough to do so? What do you actually use to make sure that all your stuff doesn't get lost?
Given the fact that I give less than a nano shit about this topic. Jeremy, do you want to go first?
I care only slightly more than Jono does, I guess. I do care enough that I do backups, but I mean, I set them up so long ago that when this topic came up, I actually had to look and go see if they were still running, which is probably not a great sign. So I don't know that restores are tested well on my personal end. But they were still running, so I guess, yes, I do them. As much as you don't want to talk about rsync, I kind of do use rsync, and that I use rsnapshot, which is, you know, basically just uses rsync to manage weekly, dailies, and monthlies.
This for? Is this the LQ forums? Is this like your own stuff? I mean, what do you use rsync for?
I use rsnapshot actually for some of the LQ stuff. That's how we back up all of our Git and SVN repositories. And then we push them to S3, which is actually similar to what I do at home. I just have a little NAS box made by QNAP, and I rsnapshot my home directories and some other stuff to that, and then push the really important bits also to S3. I'm not fancy like you guys. I don't use Dropbox or Ubuntu One, I'm sure you guys both use. But I use S3 just as a kind of secondary backup to the NAS.
Right, so bear with me. This thing you bought is just like storage, and you just mount it or something.
The QNAP, yeah, it's basically just running embedded. I think it runs Linux. It might be FreeBSD. I've never looked closely.
Well, yeah, but it's just a way to put, it's a proper little computer.
You just
put four
drives in there, RAID 1s them, and
you
can NFS mount it. I just use rsync over SSH.
All right. Oh, that seems... And so you do this kind of hardcore command line thing?
You do have to set it up via command line, I guess. Yes, I don't know if it's too hardcore, but...
It's hardcore than what I do, I'll be honest with you.
So, given that, what do you guys both do?
But this was the point of the question, right? So Jeremy's kind of hardcore, open up an Xterm in order to do backups and then never checks that they work. John,
I checked yesterday.
I've backups, you know, one set of backups that I use on my servers and then one set that I use on my client stuff. So on the server side, it really is just basically a cron job that basically SCPs files from one machine to another. It's extremely unsophisticated. It's frankly the most important thing for me to back up is the database. If I lose the rest of it, I can redeploy. I use WordPress for everything, so it's not that big of a deal. On my desktop side of things, I have, again, two different things. On my Ubuntu side, I use Ubuntu One, and I back up all of my stuff on my desktop, and that works really nicely for me. I save all of my work files into Ubuntu One. I save all of my personal stuff into Ubuntu One. But I also use Dropbox. I use Dropbox on my Mac, which I use for recording. And this is quite neat because I'm writing an album right now, so when I iterate a bit of the a song or something like that, what I'll do is I'll export it to my Dropbox, and then it'll sync it to my Ubuntu machine and my other machine, so I can listen to the song on different speakers and stuff like that, and that works out quite neatly as well.
All right, so documents and stuff is all U1.
All U1, and you know what?
You are a good company man, sir.
I try my best. And U1 works pretty nicely for me. you know, UOne and Dropbox are fairly similar, but it is nice being able to know that I can access my files on my phone and whatever else. But again, I'm pretty simple here in the sense of I just need to back them up to the cloud. I don't tend to look at my stuff on many different devices. Like with Dropbox and Ubuntu One, you can access it on lots of different devices. I don't really use that so much apart from my songs, and that's just for a single project. So.
Right, yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, the thing which put this into my head was that my laptop has started to occasionally throw disk errors. Right, and this is one of those things.
Started to,
yeah. You only get one warning.
You have experienced a litany of laptop related shit going on. I've never known anyone to have such problems. And the solution's simple: buy a fucking ThinkPad. I keep telling you this over and over again.
Right,
buy a ThinkPad.
To be clear, first of all, I'm not buying a ThinkPad because they look like they were made by the Soviet Union in 1992. I'm not buying one.
That's actually not far off these days.
To be fair to the Soviets, they make pretty good laptops.
Don't worry, Yak. You can always ignore disk errors in the beginning, I hear.
Well, no, you can't. And this is what made me think about it. And this happened with a previous laptop. As Jono mentioned, I tend to have bad luck with hardware. And when it happened with the previous laptop, I was terribly, terribly, terribly worried that I'd lose everything. This time, it started throwing errors, and I thought, okay, this is a problem. But it wasn't that much of a problem, and the reason was that I'm reasonably confident all my stuff is safe, which is brilliant. And like Monsieur Bacon, most of my stuff's in Ubuntu One. I suspect he uses Ubuntu One rather than Dropbox for the same reason that I do, which is, you know, got a nice big account. On the other hand,
not kidding.
I use UOne for my documents primarily and bits of work that I'm doing, programs that I write. Other stuff gets backed up with Deja Dupe, which is part of Ubuntu, and it backs up to the server in my house, you know, which I believe uses rsync and duplicity under the covers, but I don't understand that stuff. I just turned it on, you know, I just started it up and told it, my server is here by SSH, back things up, and I've never touched it since.
It seems nice that on the desktop side of things, backing up stuff is really simple these days. You can use Dropbox or Ubuntu One or whatever else. But on the server side, it's still a massive ball ache. Like, you still need to know how to configure this stuff. I wish I could just deploy my server using whatever, CentOS, Ubuntu, whatever, who cares? And I can just run a single script and it will take care of it for me. I wish I had the equivalent on the server side that I've got on the desktop.
You can kind of do that depending on how your server setup is.
Right, I mean, but that's just the thing. I don't want to be...
If you're doing virtualized stuff, you could just snapshot the whole thing.
Already too hard, right?
Yeah, seriously, too complicated. My feeble peanut-sized brain.
Yeah, I admit, you know, I am young and foolish and have a peanut for a brain, as Jono points out. But seriously, I mean, Deja Dupe, right? I'd have started it up and I said, my server is here, back up. Before that, I was backing up to Ubuntu One. And so I just ticked the box at Ubuntu One and said, back up, and that was it. But I got too cheap to back up stuff to the cloud when I've got a server downstairs. So, because that doesn't cost me any more money. But, you know, I mean, this stuff is easy, but yeah, servers are still really annoying. I mean, my server's okay because I don't have my own machine anymore. It's just shared hosting. So I just ticked a box which said, back this shit up. And I didn't have to do anything else, which was fab, right? It should be that easy. But yeah, it's hard on servers. And part of the reason is that half people using servers really care about this stuff. So they'll say, well, there's this incredibly complicated backup tool, like Bacula. Or whatever. Right?
Well, I used to use this pretty neat service. It's LAAS, which is language as a service.
Oh yeah,
which is where I basically say language, figure out the backups. unfortunately, language as a service was not that reliable, and the customer support was pretty terrible as well. But yeah, I mean, it seems all too much these days. You got to know somebody who can help you get this crap set up. And
I think on the server side, one reason it's probably always going to be a little bit more complicated is that the different requirements on the server side are going to be so much more varied than the desktop side.
Yeah.
So
I'm all in favor of the idea of there being some kind of complicated, decent backup tool that proper sysadmins, rather than us, can use. But but. Given that there's this big push for kind of, yeah, don't just use someone else's cloud. Don't store your data on other people's servers. You ought to be running your own servers. Like, okay, I understand that reasoning. Make it easy for me to do it. People don't use Google rather than own cloud because they like the idea of giving their data away to someone else. They do it because it's all two clicks and that's it. You know,
yeah.
And we've mostly solved that problem on the desktop, and we totally haven't solved it on the server. But well, to me, it's pleasing that it is solved on the desktop, I think. Doing this stuff is trivially easy. I think
that's like Amanda. Isn't that what they do, is easy Amanda backups or servers
right.
as a company?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing we haven't talked about is cloud backup stuff. So both John and I are using Ubuntu One, or you can use Dropbox or whatever, which is very much kind of a file management thing. But you get stuff like CrashPlan. Which I haven't used, and I'd be really interested to hear from people who have used it.
What is it?
See whether it's any good. It's similar kind of thing to, you know, pop up one window, say, back me up to CrashPlan, that's it. And it just sends the backups off. So it's like file storage, but it's only for backups. It doesn't do sync or anything like that. It doesn't make them available from your phone, and it's quite cheap, you know. Mm.
Well, I would like to add one last thing, as I know we're kind of running short on segment time here. The fact that we're doing a segment on backups invariably means one of the three of us is going to lose something very soon.
This is true. I'm also, like, my mind is literally blown by the fact that we all backup.
I know.
I was expecting us to say, this segment's going to last about 2 minutes because none of us do any backups. Maybe you, Jeremy, because you actually know what you're doing. But admittedly, though, Lunduke's not here, so he probably doesn't have a backup plan.
But he only uses Android now, right? So presumably all his stuff is just on Google Drive at this point.
Filthy fucking sellout.
And now on to what is one of my personal favorite parts of the show, listener feedback. So we got a good amount of feedback once again for this episode, and both Ali Najafi and James Hanna suggested that we cover Jala Phone and Selfish OS, and I think that's a good idea. I think we'll probably incorporate some of the other open source phones like Firefox OS and most likely Ubuntu Phone. They get a working version of shipping ever.
Thanks, then, by the way.
Nice. You're welcome.
And I'd also like to thank Mirko Mueller, sorry about that, who suggested that we discuss Bitcoin. We'll certainly add that to the list of potential topics for the future.
Oh, man, Bitcoin.
I think that'd be good. I think those two topics are pretty good ideas. I mean, I care less about Bitcoin, but there's lots of open source operating systems around. I think it would be good to maybe we could do a review of all of them, or we could discuss all of them. I don't know.
You're once again a good company man.
We should probably talk about Bitcoin. Yes, I want to just
cryptocurrency in general, not just Bitcoin.
Well, yeah, but I mean, not that many people sit around and say, "Well, let's discuss, you know, the psychological and social impacts of the yen." It just exists. Just make Bitcoin exist, so I can spend it on things, and then that's it.
Yeah, it's one of those topics that I will never ever understand enough to talk coherently. You know, I'm constantly reminded of my mediocrity in topics like that. Well, and in general, we had an email from Daniel Anderson who said, "Great interview with Greg KH on the last show. That dude is a beast, quite literally. You should get him back on sometime to do a state of the Linux kernel speech like he does sometimes. Also, I'll miss the dirty haikus. Too bad Brian wasn't there for that. Well, you know what? Brian's a slacker, so yeah, not too bad.
Isn't
and
he
no
just?
More dirty haikus.
I was going to say, I would like to reiterate, still no more dirty haikus.
We're done.
Yes,
absolutely. No more. And then we also had an email from Arthur Tan, who said, "Hi guys, love the show. Any thoughts about doing a video feed on YouTube of the recording a la Linux Outlaws or the Ubuntu UK podcast?"
I got a thought. Love the interview. No. How about that?
No.
It's funny, I have that same thought.
Yeah, we're not doing that.
A few people have asked this in the past, why we do audio only. There's a few reasons for this. First of all, we could just do a hangout. And yeah, it would be simple. It would be a lot easier to produce. But the production of the show is very, very important to all of us. We want it to be a really high quality show in terms of the content and in terms of the audio production. We basically can't achieve that with video. It would require a massive amount of equipment and engineering and editing and all that kind of stuff for us to do it. And it wouldn't really buy us very much. And I think there's a certain romanticism about radio as well. It's kind of more interesting to not see who's on it, particularly with our faces. So, so no video.
No video, absolutely not. Now, we had an email from a chap called Jens Klun, and ordinarily, I think people might be quite pleased that that we read their email and inwardly digested it. But the first thing he says is, I wish you didn't read as many emails. So, you know, he says, I really don't care what Jane Doe in Tuscaloosa, Texas said about your show. I know it's important to you and your show. But Jens also gives some additional feedback. The first thing, this is going to go like the video thing, I think, but he suggests in Germany, a normal tech podcast is between 2 and 4.5 hours for each episode. Chaps, how do you feel about the idea of a 4.5 hour show?
Similar to the video feed. No.
I just made a sick in my mouth.
Yeah, I like the idea of the fact that people would want to listen to us for 4.5 hours. So what I'd suggest you do is every 2 months, get the last 4 shows and listen to them all at once.
Or listen to it on repeat. I hear it's better the second time than it is the first.
No, I miss all the jokes first time around.
I don't think anyone has ever, ever, ever said that.
But yeah, I mean, the other chap, Jens, also brings up a thing called the Pod Love Project, which is semi-interesting, actually. These people, they've put together some additional specifications for ways to specify podcasts. Because, I mean, basically, the idea of the technological metadata around podcasts hasn't moved on since they invented RSS, apart from the bit where the iTunes people invented a load of new stuff and everyone fell in line. The Podlove project put together a bunch of specs for things like how to specify in your RSS feed where the chapters are, where the different segments are, so on and so forth, right? Seems like a good idea, but it also seems like quite a lot of work, having looked into it. So I'm bearing it in mind, but I wouldn't hold your breath. But, Herr Klun, thank you very much for the suggestions. I very much appreciate you letting me know about the Podlove project, and we'll see what we can do.
Yes, so, get your... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, so on that note, as always, thanks for the feedback. Please do keep it coming, and show@badvoltage.org is once again the email address for you to submit that feedback. And Jono, the erudite gentleman that he is, also established a discourse community for us, and that's at community.badvoltage.org. So hop on over there and let us know what you think.
And that's the end of episode 4, so time to go to the pub, right?
I hope so. Even though it's, you know,
I was going to say it's a little early over here
in the afternoon.
Ah, well, Americans, whatever, you've got no idea. However, while you're on the way to the pub, what you ought to do, drop us an email. Send us your feedback, your thoughts on who we should interview, who we should talk to, what we should talk about, what you thought of what we talked about in this episode. Send us emails to show@badvoltage.org.
And one thing that's very, very important to us is we want to build a big family around Bad Voltage. You know, like people who are listening to the show want it to be a very interactive show. So we've set up a community, and this is at community.badvoltage.org. You can go to the Bad Voltage website and click on the community link. And this is basically a very fancy discourse forum where you can meet other listeners. You can have conversations about topics that relate to the show. You can suggest ideas for interviews, reviews, things like that. And just get to know the community and be part of the community. We've done this with previous podcasts, with like people organize clan gaming events and stuff like that. We want to do all of that good stuff with Bad Voltage as well. So go to community.badvoltage.org.
Also, I've just won community bingo. Do I know you said community 13 times? Well done.
Maybe I should add a little ding noise every time.
Already been done once. So after you visit our community site, we'd also appreciate it if any social media accounts you may have, be it Google+, Twitter, Facebook, what have you, do help spread the word about Bad Voltage.
Yeah, yeah. So tell people about us on Diaspora. That'd be a good idea.
Fuck off with Diaspora. And MySpace. Let's not forget MySpace.
Friendster.
Does someone have a Friendster account? Yeah, Orchid in there somewhere.
Tell all of your friends on ICQ.
I've still got an ICQ account. Does it still work?
We should test it.
We should test it. We should start using it to record the show.
Anyway, so that's it. We hope to have Brian back at the next episode. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time.
Brian, we hope you get well soon. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Get well soon. Thanks for listening.